Welcome back. You're inside of the Africa Forum. It is Running Africa, and we go through until 10 o'clock. We're speaking with Professor Gerald Horn. Professor Horn holds the Moores Professorship of History and African-American Studies. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. Dr. Horn is the author of more than 30 books and over 100 scholarly articles and reviews. Prof, thanks for staying with us. In the book, you talked about and quoted Hubert, who says, settler colonialism is categorically different from non-settler colonialism. One of the reasons why I want you to spend some time talking about that is because we have spent so much time these last few years talking about settler colonialism. Just recently, in an interview with one of our sisters from Hawaii and our own Dr. Figaro here on the ground in Jamaica, they pointed to the fact that, listen, we are concerned about settler colonialism from the perspective of China and Jamaica, but we must also remember that the Tainos were here before, and we must remember what happened in Africa and the Maafa. So how does settler colonialism differ from non-settler colonialism?
Well, I think the answer is rather simple. I mean, look, for example, at Southern Africa. You know that just as London was moving into Jamaica in 1655, you had the Dutch arriving at the tip of Africa, the Cape, in 1652. And for various reasons, the Dutch decide to settle there, and eventually the Dutch, which is a predominantly Protestant country, are joined by French Protestants. France is a predominantly Catholic country. There was a French Protestant population known as the Huguenots, who were generally expelled, and many of them joined the Dutch in a settler colonial project in what is now South Africa. Some of them, of course, wound up in North America. Some of them actually wound up in Jamaica as well. So settler colonialism involves a colonialism where there's a resident population. Now, recall a few moments ago I talked about Sao Tome off the western coast of Africa.
Yes.
That was originally a settler colonial project that was going to involve slavery. Mm-hmm. That is to say, just like Columbus and his comrades, they came to the Americas and they were going to establish these settlements and then enslave the Tainos and the Arawaks. Well, these Europeans were going to come to Sao Tome and do the same thing, except they were expelled. If you look at colonialism in West Africa, for example, for various reasons, those were not necessarily settler colonial projects. Those were colonial projects that were based upon military rule. That is to say, the fact that the Europeans had been able to gain an advantage in terms of the development of weapons. This allowed for the outfitting of armies that could then be used to shoot down any Africans who were rebelling. But that was more or less a, quote, pure, unquote, form of colonialism, mm-hmm. not involving the settling of resident populations, which was the case in South Africa, which was the case in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, which was the case in Namibia, which used to be called German Southwest Africa. Recall that the first genocide of the 20th century took place in Namibia, at about 1904 to 1908, with the eradication, generally speaking, of the Nama and Herero populations mm-hmm. by German colonialists, who, by the way, then went on mm-hmm. to perpetrate what is referred to, at least here in the United States, as the Holocaust in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s. So you must draw a distinction between settler colonial projects, such as that which unfolded in North America and in South Africa. And also, you mentioned Hawaii. Also, you know, I wrote a book on Hawaii, which I would recommend to your listeners, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War. The focus of that book is Hawaii and how you have this independent Hawaii kingdom and how the independent Hawaii kingdom was seeking to prevent U.S. nationals, Euro-Americans, after the U.S. Civil War concludes in 1865 from coming there and starting a new slave trade involving Polynesians and Melanesians. Melanesians look like me. I'm a dark-skinned African. Mm-hmm. And they were taking these Melanesians and Polynesians to work as bonded laborers in Queensland, Australia, and Fiji. The Hawaii Kingdom interceded. They tried to work out an alliance with a rising Japan in order to prevent that from happening. For their efforts, they were overthrown by the U.S. government in the 1890s. Then, of course, Hawaii was incorporated into the United States in a rather brutal form of settler colonialism in 1959 as the presumed final state of the United States of America. And, of course, you may know as a final footnote that the 44th U.S. president, Barack Obama, was born there in 1961, unless you believe Donald J. Trump before September 2016, when he said that's not true. He was actually born in Kenya, East Africa.
Mm-hmm. Of course we don't. All right. But, you know, what's interesting about all of this, Puff, and we want to continue the conversation, but at the end of the day, so we're reading this book, and I think this is critical to even the conversation and the debates we're having here on the ground in Jamaica regarding reparations, repatriation without a doubt, but definitely reparations for yourself. I mean, you have written so many books, you have done so much in the field. Situate this apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, etc., within the wider context of the call for reparations. CARICOM is making that call now. Jamaica has been making that call. Scotland has said that they see where they were complicit, and now they are, you know, about to pay some kind of reparations. But we see a colonial bastion like the University of the West Indies here on the ground in Jamaica, for example, talking about having that kind of partnership with Scotland in terms of the how reparations are paid. And so there's more than confusion on the ground here. How does all of what we have been discussing here this morning and your book and your work in particular fit into the wider context of the debate regarding reparations for slavery?
Well, first of all, I take my hat off to the peoples of the Caribbean for being in the vanguard of the struggle, the just struggle for reparations. And in a sense, this is understandable because unlike we here in North America, you enjoy sovereignty. That means you have representation at the United Nations, you have representation in the Organization of American States and the World Health Organization and other multilateral bodies. And therefore, it allows you to make alliances to pressure London and Washington and Paris and Madrid and Lisbon to come forward with a reparations program. Now, it's interesting, as you know, when slavery was abolished in the Caribbean, the slave owners got reparations. When slavery was abolished in Haiti, the French government punished the Haitian government by forcing it to pay reparations, not to the enslaved, but to the enslavers, which helped to cripple the Haitian government for decades, if not centuries to come. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, when slavery was abolished here in the United States, neither the slave owners nor the enslaved got reparations. And in fact, one of the reasons why racism is so intense here in the United States is that these slave owners, many of whom had put their fortunes into investing in Africans, became penniless after that property was nullified and that property was abolished. And so therefore, when they see people like me walking around, they see a lost fortune, and it infuriates them and makes them angry. So certainly, I take my hat off to the people of the Caribbean for being in the vanguard of this just struggle for reparations. We here in North America are looking to you for leadership because you have sovereignty. You can work out global alliances to pressure these former slave owners and to ensure that the destiny and future of our children and grandchildren would be better than what we have had to endure.
Professor Gerald Horn, thank you so much. Much appreciated that you took the time. We know you're traveling a lot this Black History Month and that you took the time to speak with us this morning. We look forward to inviting you. We have already invited you. Please check your email to be. I know I can be like that, Professor, to be our guest speaker here at our tribute to Mwalimu Marcus Mosiah Garvey in August, and also to be available for our book club as we continue to read the book. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Professor Gerald Horn there, the Morris Professorship of History and African American Studies. He holds that. And as we said before, his research addressing issues of racism in a variety of relations, including labor politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. Thanks once again to the professor.